It's the time of year when we're all thinking about goals and priorities. Now is the time to plan your next trip. Whatever kind of travel fills you up, whether it's lounging on the beach, connecting with family and friends, or going on a foreign adventure, Expedia has the tools you need to plan a great trip. Download the Expedia app or visit Expedia.com to start planning. You do need to be a One Key member to use price tracking. Signing up is easy and free. Expedia, made to travel.
Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed at home in your Keurig coffee maker with Dunkin' cold K-Cup pods. Just brew it hot over ice and enjoy flavor that's crafted to serve cold. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
I'm Oprah Winfrey. Welcome to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. I believe that one of the most valuable gifts you can give yourself is time. Taking time to be more fully present. Your journey to become more inspired and connected to the deeper world around us starts right now.
Miss Oprah.
Oh, girl. Too, I love
it. Sweetheart.
Miss
Hi.
Oprah, how you doing? Good to see you.
It's good to see you. You look beautiful.
Oh, so do you.
Thank you for having me back.
Ah, of course, of course.
Good to see you.
This book is something, girl.
Yeah, you like it?
Yeah. So, welcome. Welcome.
Hey, here we are again.
You know, we first met in 2007.
I know, so long ago.
Yes.
Many, many things have happened since then.
Oh my gosh, your life since 2007.
Well, yours too.
My life since 2007.
To be fair.
Your life, I mean, look at what's happened in that amount of time. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a lot. The world's life since 2007.
The world's life since 2007.
A lot of big changes on the macro, micro level.
Everything. But I have to say, you know, when I first met you and we were celebrating, reveling in Eat, Pray, Love, I said then that you were a carrier of the light. We could see that in you. And even after all that you've been through, love and death and love and everything, that you still carry that light.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that.
Still so strong in you.
Thank you for saying that.
Still so strong in you.
It's that flame has flickered. Mm-hmm. You know, the wick has gone down at various times over the last few years. But honestly, Oprah, I came here to live a life fully, all of it, and I'll take it. I'll take all of it. I'll take the whole thing because I don't want to miss it. I don't want to have come all this distance to live a human life and miss the experience. So I just want to show up for the whole ride.
Damn it, I love
it
that.
Be, you
I
know,
love that.
Like, I came here to do this.
Yeah.
You know, all of it.
And so you just embrace whatever shows up, you embrace it.
Maybe not in the moment that it's actually happening and horrible, mm-hmm. but there's even then, there's something, you know, even in the worst moments of watching Rhea die, there was something I knew, and it was that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Mm. This is the worst thing I've ever been in, and I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Which is the essence of everything that I talk about in this format of Super Soul, is that being able to be in the present moment and to make peace with whatever that moment is showing up for you.
Yeah.
That's when you have reached the spiritual heights of, as a human being.
Yeah, and to figure out what am I being asked to do and learn and grow out of this.
Right now.
Right now.
Right now.
You know, why?
What is this moment here to offer me, to teach me,
And if I'm going to assume that this is a friendly universe, and I keep assuming it, mm-hmm. oftentimes despite all evidence, then why is this being offered to me? And you know, in this amount of pain, what's the lesson here? What am I meant to?
What is hard to believe is that you were writing this book. Were you writing your new book through all of that pain with Rhea? You waited until she passed and then finished.
What happened is that I started working on this book 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I started doing a ton of research. You know, it's about New York City in the 1940s,
yes. mm-hmm.
showgirls, theater. And the vision that I always had for it was a big, happy, frolicsome. I wanted to go down like a mm-hmm. champagne cocktail, like a lighthearted, giddy book.
Well, it feels like a fun, lighthearted romp.
That's it. That's what I wanted to do.
You
know, that's what I wanted it to do. Like, I want it to go down easy and to, before you know it, you're done with it and you've had this great ride. And to be having.
That's why it's great for summer.
Exactly.
And that's probably why you're releasing it.
That is probably why, because
they
are, my publishers are not fools. It's a You know, it's a fun, lighthearted book.
Yeah.
So I got all the research done, and I was about to sit down and start writing it, and that's when I got the phone call saying that my best friend, who really had truly for years been the most important person to my heart and my life, had terminal cancer. My life at that minute just absolutely shifted. Within the course of a week, my entire life radically changed. I ended up leaving my marriage, going to take care of her in her sickness, spent the next 18 months at her side, and the last thing I could imagine caring about was a novel about showgirls in the 1940s, a happy, like, gleeful, sexy. I couldn't begin to imagine ever caring about it again. So I didn't do anything with it for 18 months. And then very soon after she died, I don't know, I got a message from the mothership saying, the best thing you could do for yourself right now is write that book. It's going to bring you back to life. So I started writing it right after she died, and it did. This happy, fun, frolicsome light book I wrote during the deepest
grief. It's so interesting because, well, now you explain it, because I was like, how are you writing that going through what we all knew you were going through? So you waited until she had passed.
Yeah.
And no doubt, Rhea left the spirit of her and the light of her with you, and that's why you were able to do City of Girls.
I think so. I felt her with me while I was doing it. I talked to her the whole time I was doing it, and I was trying to crack her up while I was writing it.
What a perfect name, though. What a perfect name, City of Girls.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Can you believe that's never been the name of a book?
When I
came up with it, I looked all over. I was like, somebody has to have called something this, and it has never been a title before, and it just feels like such a good title.
It is
like,
such a perfect title. Such a perfect title, and such a perfect title for such a time as this.
Mm.
Yeah. How would you describe the book?
I'd say
it's a fun, lighthearted romp.
That's good. I'll go with that.
Good. Okay.
Oprah Winfrey, fun, lighthearted romp. It is a joyous novel about New York City in the 1940s, about showgirls, about theater, about actresses, it's actually deeply about promiscuous girls and about girls being very wild in their youth. But it's written like a fake memoir from
yes.
the point of view of a woman in her 90s looking back at her youth when she was wild and crazy.
You know, it's interesting because we don't have permission to be promiscuous.
Yeah.
And I remember growing up that was the one thing, and this reminded me so much of it, that the one thing in our neighborhood, in our culture, was like called being fast.
Yeah.
Oh, she's fast.
Yeah.
She's too fast.
Yeah.
And so it was so frowned upon, and yet you write about characters who are willing to release that at a time when it also was frowned upon.
It's always been frowned upon. And it's still frowned upon. And those girls are still ostracized.
Yes.
And there are still women who have a tremendous amount of sexual curiosity and courage and bravery and a kind of desire to live on the edge. And that's what this book is about. It's about those kind of girls.
Well, I love this part of the book where you say, I could have spent the rest of my life trying to prove that I was a good girl. But that would have been unfaithful to who I really was. I believed that I was a good person, if not a good girl. But my appetites were what they were. So I gave up on the idea of denying myself what I truly wanted. Then I sought ways to delight myself. As long as I stayed away from married men, I felt that I was doing no harm. Anyway, at some point in a woman's life, she just gets tired of being ashamed all the time. And after that, she's free to become whoever she truly is. Say it, girl.
Amen. You found it. That, to me, is the
That's
most
it.
Essential part
That's
of
it.
The entire book. And by the way, can I just sit here and have you read the entire thing to me?
But
it
that
makes
to me
so
is the essential,
happy to hear you read
that
it.
That, to me, is the essential part of the
That's
book.
That's it. That's what the whole book is about.
And
now, when she's writing that piece, she's writing it from her 50s. So the book begins with her at 19. She goes to New York City. She goes on a bender. She falls in with a group of showgirls who are all very wild. Her appetites are what they are, and she just jumps in right in with them. This is not to say that there are no consequences. This is what I want to point out. What I wanted to say in this book is that I wanted to write a counterpoint to all the stories that are told of girls who are promiscuous and their lives are destroyed by it. And what I wanted to tell was the story of girls who are promiscuous, and then they continue to have rich and interesting lives after that. And while they had consequences from it, and while things might have been difficult, they survived it. And not only survived, but maybe at some point look back on it in their later years and go, there's a lot of fun that I was having during that time.
I'm glad I did that.
I'm kind of glad I did that. And so she's writing that while she's in her 50s, looking back at herself at 19, but she wouldn't have been able at 19 to articulate what she was doing. She was just following these urges and wanting to be as daring as the wild girls she was running around with.
When you look back on your own life at 19 and the girl that you were, what would you say to her now?
nothing she would have listened to or respected or obeyed. So I could tell her all kinds of things, but she's still going to go off and do exactly what she was going to go do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like when I look back at her face, I see someone who is committed to the path that she was on and had to be, because it took me to where I am now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they say that every novel is a memoir. And every memoir is a novel.
Yes.
That if you really want to know what somebody's like, read the novels that they write.
My
memoir.
I thought I was talking to you.
Yeah,
I knew that was you, of course.
I didn't have to do any research to describe what it's like to be a young, fast girl.
Yes.
Because that's what I was. And, yeah, there was no stopping me. You know?
Yeah.
I wanted to experience everything, Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
And I did pay consequences for it, but I also kind of get why I was like that.
But what I think is so interesting about City of Girls is that so many adult women and men spend time regretting actually what they may have done in their youth or punishing themselves for actually being a sexual being.
Yeah.
And your intention for writing this was to say, release that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the great things about this research that I did for this book was that I got to meet a lot of women in their 90s who had been showgirls, dancers, actresses back in the day in Broadway, and interview them. And one of the things I'd been worried about when I went into that was, how am I going to get these women in their 90s to talk to me about
sex? Yes.
It was more like, how am I going to get them to talk about anything but sex? Like, once I started, they were...
Because nobody's asked them.
Nobody's asked them.
Yes.
Everybody's too respectful. And there was one woman in particular whose name was Norma, and she was a showgirl, and she lives in the same apartment in the Upper West Side that she moved into in 1950. She was John Wayne's girlfriend. She was Milton Berle's girlfriend. She was a dancer and a glamour girl all through the 40s and 50s. Never got married, never had kids, had affairs her entire life, was a sexual being for her entire life, even up to very close to the age when I met her in her 90s. And, you know, I wasn't sure when I was writing this book, can I get away with this? Would it have been accurate that there would have been girls like this in the 40s? And I met Norma and I said, did you ever regret that you never got married, that you never had kids? And she just looked at me and said, honey, who wants to have sex with the same man for 60 straight years? And she didn't say have sex. She said it in a lot rougher language
really?
Than that. Yeah, and I was like, whoa. And her telling me that just opened up. She said, I don't regret any of it. I had a wonderful life. I had so many fascinating... She said that, and the door was always open. And men could come in, they could leave. You know, it just, everybody was free.
How do you find writing about women's sexuality in the 40s, in the era of City of the Girls, compared to the world today with Me Too and Time's Up?
Well, I started working on this book before Me Too started, mm-hmm. and it was interesting that it intersected, that I was writing this book that was about a certain kind of female sexuality when a very different conversation is going on right now. It was important to me. I thought about it, but it was really important to me when I sat down to write it that I didn't make these girls prematurely woke. I have a problem when I read historical fiction, when there are characters who are more advanced in their thinking than they would have been at that era.
Yeah.
You know, where you're reading a 16th century scullery maid, but she talks about feminist theory like she went to Vassar.
Right.
You know, and you're like, no.
No.
You know, like,
Doesn't fit. You can be strong. Yeah.
You can be a strong, powerful female character, but you can't have access to information that didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
And so I tried to, I mean, everything I ever write is going to be from a feminist perspective because I'm a feminist, but I tried to not have them be ahead of themselves in terms of understanding their
relationships. So if they're not woke, they're waking up.
They're not woke, but they're waking. And mm-hmm. and there comes a moment in the book where for instance, there's an incident where that's kind of the hinge upon which all the drama in the book occurs, where she makes a very big mistake, a bunch of situations blow up. And she looks back on it later, and it takes her decades to realize, wait a minute, the girls got banished, but the guys... was fine. He got to keep his position and his prestige and his marriage. And why did we get thrown out of town? Like, why did that happen? But it took her 20 years to realize that there was maybe something unfair about that. And certainly at the time in 1940, she wouldn't have had that awareness. She would have just felt ashamed and that she was, as she was labeled, a dirty little whore. But the guy was
which
not
is the
that.
Which is being labeled a dirty little whore is the thing that everybody's always trying to run away from because everybody wants to be the good girl.
Yeah,
good girl.
Yeah.
Of course.
But I believe you can be a good person without necessarily being a good girl. And I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
And that's what you're telling us in City of Girls.
I hope to.
Yes, yes.
I hope to.
Well, let's talk about what's happened in these years since we last sat down.
Yeah.
So when you got the notice that Rhea had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I have a friend who's going through it now, and there's just, yeah. So when you got that,
yeah.
would you say you were happily married at the time?
I would. And there's a limit to how much I want to talk about the marriage just out of respect to somebody who I
yeah.
still love and care about
yeah.
deeply.
Mm-hmm.
But
are y'all still friends?
I still love and care about him deeply.
Okay, good. So I'll leave it at that.
That's, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
And always will.
Uh-huh.
But when
well,
I...
You know, so many people who read Eat, Pray, Love were vested in you holding on to that forever
yeah.
because that love that you all found was like our love too.
Right.
And so when you posted that you were going to be leaving,
yeah.
I mean, people felt like it was somebody they knew.
Yeah, but they were so loving, Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you read the comments that people put on, mm-hmm. on Facebook when I posted, it was just so much love and understanding because I actually think I love my readers so much. My readers tend to be middle-aged women who've been through a lot,
yeah.
who are the kindest people in the world, who understand that life is messy and things change. And I think everyone gets that my life didn't end on the last page of Eat, Pray, Love. That story ended.
Yeah.
But my life continued on, and I had to live forward into it. And when Raya...
I'm just going to read the post. I'm separating
ahead.
From the man whom many of you know as Felipe, the man whom I fell in love with at the end of Eat, Pray, Love journey. And I hope you'll understand and forgive me if I'm a bit absent from social media during this sensitive moment. So I know you to be a woman who actually lives with your heart open. I'm wondering, were you concerned at the time about actually upsetting the readers? Were you?
No.
You were not?
I wasn't. I had such bigger fish to fry, Oprah.
Yeah.
You know, I was going through the most important person I had ever known, the most important person in my life was dying. I was separating from the man I loved because I knew I had to. Because it almost felt like, this may sound odd to say, it didn't feel like a decision that I made. It felt like I was obeying a mandate.
Mm-hmm.
There was something that I had to do.
To take care of Raya.
To take care of Raya and to take care of her as her partner and as her lover and to acknowledge that that she was the love of my life.
So later in that same year, you posted, I'm just
yeah.
doing this for all the people who...
Yeah, catch them up.
Okay, catch them up for all the people. That there is something I wish to tell you today, something which I hope and trust you will receive with grace. This spring, I received news that would change my life forever. My best friend, Raya, was diagnosed with pancreatic and liver cancer, a disease for which there's no cure. The moment I first learned of Raya's diagnosis, a trapdoor opened at the bottom of my heart. A trapdoor I didn't even know was there, and my entire existence fell straight through that door. Death, or the prospect of death, has a way of clearing away everything that is not real. And in that space of stark and utter realness, I was faced with this truth. I do not merely love Raya, I am in love with Raya. Okay. I actually read that post that, you know, when you posted it.
And you reached out to me very
yes,
kindly,
did.
As did a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's it. That was it.
And you've described your love for Raya as a life-shattering truth. As a life-shattering truth.
You know, she...
Did you surprise yourself when you fell in love with her?
No. And not only that, it didn't surprise her or anyone who knew us.
Mm.
And I mean anyone. There was nobody.
Yeah, you know what? I saw
there
you all together. We were on tour.
Nobody who was surprised.
Yeah, when I saw you on tour, and, you know, and Yigel and I have been friends for years, too.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have that.
Yeah.
There was just something that was like, I went, okay.
People's reactions went from, duh, to, I thought you guys had been secretly having an affair for years.
Really?
To a friend of Reyes who wrote back, in other news, ice is cold. You know, like, you know, this is the most obvious thing. It was so obvious to all of us, you know, or we'd been wondering when you guys were going to notice.
Because when I saw you all and you hadn't announced it yet, but you all were like actually holding hands and
we
were looking into each other's eyes and you were like giddy.
We were so intimate. What's going on here? But it was so, I was so determined to not cross that boundary, and it was so important to me to be a faithful and honest wife, and I believe I was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I believe I was because the minute that clarity came to me, and I mean the minute, the next conversation I had was with my husband.
Really?
The next minute.
Yeah.
There's like, there's no
But you'd already moved out, right?
No, this was...
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was the minute. It was like,
okay.
this was... There was no way that I could know this about myself, that I was in love with Rhea, and he couldn't know that. I felt that that would be so unfair.
Right.
And so instantly that conversation happened, and instantly our decision was made that we would separate.
Wow.
It was okay. So fast, because he knew too. Everybody knew, you know, and it was Rhea. I mean, it was a special, and she was dying. There was no time for, it just cleared everything away, and it was so obvious that this is what had to occur. And I felt, at the moment that I found out that she was dying, I had a vision, and it was the worst thing I've ever seen. I saw it like a movie. And the vision was, I mean, I knew I would be the one taking care of Rhea. I knew I would be with her every moment. I knew I would be with her at the moment of her death. I had this movie that I saw, and it was me in a hospital room watching Rhea die, holding her hand, having taken care of her through her death, and her leaving this world never having known what she was to my heart. And then me going on the rest of my life and no one ever having known and nothing ever being said about it. And it was so
appalling.
So
you had a vision of this?
I had a vision of that.
Okay.
And it was so appalling. My soul was appalled is the only way I can describe it.
Oh.
My soul was appalled that I will not let that happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, you couldn't let that happen.
I will not let that happen.
Yeah.
And
because that would have been akin to dying.
I would have died with her.
A slow.
I would have died with her.
Yeah, death yourself. Yeah.
And the rest of my life would have been a parched post-apocalyptic landscape. Honestly, that's mm-hmm. what I saw. And I saw that, and there was no way I could allow that. And so I just.
So before that, so I'm just trying to get it straight in my own head, because I think I was confused that it was after she was diagnosed with the cancer mm-hmm. that you left. You left your husband
yes.
after she was diagnosed with the
yes.
cancer.
Immediately. After.
You're now with her.
Yeah.
And then you fell in love with her.
No. No.
Okay.
No. First of all, it would be hard for me to track when I fell in love with her.
Okay, good.
That had been, you know, quietly in my heart
for a long
time.
Yes.
But I was married. I got a call from her saying she was diagnosed with cancer. I saw that vision. She's going to die. And she's
not going to know.
She's not going to know. And I will never have been honest with myself, with her, or with the world.
Had you been honest with yourself up until that point? You had not?
To an extent, but it was just sort of like, nothing will ever come of this. I will never cross this line.
You all were just going around,
I was like,
staring into each other's eyes and holding hands
and having the world think that we were in love. But I just thought, you know, if you love her, then love her. Just love her.
Okay.
Just love her.
So you never crossed the line.
Never crossed the line. But then the thought of her departing without that having been made clear.
And you got that vision only after you heard the diagnosis.
Only after that she was sick. And then when I went and told her my feelings, she always laughed at me because she said, you sounded like you were in third grade. You said, do you like me that way? Do you like me that way? And
really?
I said...
How soon after you had the feeling did you tell?
Within a week. And
so you told your husband first?
So imagine her life.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
I told my husband first.
Okay.
But imagine her life. She gets diagnosed with terminal cancer, and then her best friend says, I'm in love with you, and I've been in love with you, and I want to be with you. And she said, how can I be so happy and dying at the same time? She was so happy. And she said, I never dreamed in a million years. I never dreamed that we would have this. But when I told her, I love you, I said, what does that feel like? And she said, it feels like prophecy.
Wow.
Prophecy. And she said, I feel like a 1,000 angels just breathed into my heart. And we had such a strange heightened time
of
dying and love and, you know, all of it.
Help me, Liz. I want to be fully woke and open here. Had you ever had a feeling of loving a woman before? Or it doesn't not even matter if it's a woman or not a woman?
I think it matters
yeah.
in the least. I, that piece of it was, to me, in my post when I announced it, it didn't even occur to me to sort of address that, because I was like, who cares? Like,
yeah.
I can imagine caring.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't even cross my mind. And I did laugh, because at the end of that Facebook post where I made my big public announcement,
yeah.
I said, I do have one favor to ask you. You know, if you want to respect me and Rhea, I have one favor to ask you. Please don't start assailing us with your cures. You know, when somebody's got cancer, the cures start coming in, the miracle cures. You got to go to this doctor. You got to. I said, please, I know you mean
eat
well.
Eat this, do that, blah, blah, blah.
You know, magical miracles. I said, please don't do that to us.
Yeah.
She's choosing her own path. This is her business. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my only request. And somebody on Facebook said, when you said I've got a favor to ask or a request to make, I swear I thought you were going to say, don't judge me for being with a woman. I was like, why would I say that? Why would I ask you to not judge me? I'm not judging me. You know, like, that's crazy. It didn't even cross my mind that that would be a concern. Love is love.
It didn't even cross your mind?
It didn't even cross my mind. It really didn't.
You are a highly elevated human being.
I don't know about that, but I do know that I throw my heart into the world like the way they shoot T-shirts out of T-shirt cannons in concerts. You know, I mean, that's how I love. It's that, it's just, it's that big.
Are you ready to unlock your inner greatness? If so, make sure to listen to my podcast, The School of Greatness, hosted by me, Lewis Howes. Join me as I sit down with world-class performers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders to uncover their secrets to success with new episodes every single week. Whether you're striving for personal growth, business mastery, or simply seeking inspiration, The School of Greatness has something for you, and you can find it on SiriusXM, Pandora, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe and follow to the show so you never miss an episode and start your journey to greatness today.
And so what did loving her through until the end teach you about life and love?
An enormous amount of humility because I had this idea that I was going to be the world's greatest caregiver and that I would sort of honestly be kind of a hero. And I was broken by the burden, not, and the burden is not the right word, it was savage going through that. And that there were other elements of it too that arose. Rhea had been a heroin addict for years as a young person, and she'd been sober for 19 years. And when they put her back on opioids for the enormous pain that she was in, it kicked up all of that again. And she went into a very dark spiral with the drugs that she was on. And I essentially felt as though I had lost her. Before I lost her, I was prepared to lose her to death, but I wasn't prepared to see her descend into addiction again. She came out of it miraculously. She went through it. I think it was part of her own rage at dying, where she just got a case of like, oh, screw this. I'm just going to, you know, throw it away.
Yeah.
And going through that was this whole other level of hell.
So was she still functioning? Was she still able to be up and moving around and coherent?
She was, yeah, but it was tough. And the humility was... that
because you stopped everything to be by her side.
I dropped my entire life to take
all your scheduling. Everything. You stopped the writing.
I remember the day she was diagnosed, going through my inbox and deleting every single email. I don't care. I don't care about anything except her. I don't care. Nothing in the world matters except her. And there got to a point where anybody who's been a caregiver, especially for somebody who's not an easy patient, and Rhea was not an easy patient. She was a very powerful, strong, you know, independent, ferocious person in many ways. It broke me. And who ended up rescuing me was Rhea's ex-wife from 10 years ago and her ex-girlfriend from 20 years ago, who showed up like angels and stepped in and said, you can't do this alone. And the three of us ended up taking care of her while she was dying. And the humility that I experienced where these women showed up, gave up their lives for their ex-partner to come and help her current partner take care of the woman we all loved. And it ended up being the most beautiful act of love I've ever seen was not me giving up my life to take care of Rhea, but Gigi and Stacy giving up their lives to take care of me while I took care of Rhea.
Because I heard that she went out fighting.
Fighting, tooth and nail. I mean, she was a thug. Yes. It's why we all loved her. She was a massive personality and she was obstinate and she was the alpha wolf in every situation. And, you know, she did not humble herself before death.
Well, it's so interesting because I know there are people who are hearing us and watching us. And I was just visiting a friend who is suffering from Alzheimer's. And on the day that I went to visit, the family member said, oh, she's having a good day today. Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's being nice today, and you know, sometimes she isn't. And so there you know, the family members are waiting for whatever that wrath may show up. And even I was too, like, oh God, please don't be, you know, mean to me.
Yeah,
and so when
brutal.
People are being mean to you and you're in the midst of trying to care for them, it's hard to want to hang in there.
It's brutal.
It's brutal.
And that's why I needed, look, we're not supposed to do life alone. This idea that I'm going to be the one, you know,
yes,
ever. It's never been my story. It's always been a gathering of people, yeah, coming together to help each other.
I love your truth in it. Your vision from the beginning was that I'm going to be Florence Nightingale. I'm going to be there by your side. I'm going to be all the things. And then
try that after 8 days of no sleep and a patient who's in constant pain and who's lost her own patience with you. And I mean, you can't. If you're the caregiver and the primary, most important person of your life is dying, someone needs to be taking care of you.
Mm.
You know, that's what Gigi and Stacey.
Hear that, folks.
Somebody
Hear
needs
that.
To be taking care of you because you can't be the hero. You're
you.
Also dying.
Yeah.
Because you're also losing this person at the
yes.
same time, and you're going through your own emotional trauma.
Wow.
So that was the humility where I had to surrender to the fact that I can't do this myself. And then these women showed up and just held me mm-hmm. so that we could all take care of her together. It was the most beautiful act of love I've ever witnessed in my life.
So were you all there for the last moment?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, we were. And and she went down like Rhea. I mean, she went down swinging. It was not a peaceful, graceful, Zen death. It was a Rhea Elias death. You know, we said later, we were like laughing and crying at the same time saying, whoever came from the other side to get her has scratches and bruises all over them. You know, she did not go
really?
Easy. But that's how her life was. She was such a force of nature, and she went out like a storm at sea. And it was brutal, and it was beautiful, and it was true to who she was. And it was an honor to be there.
Mm.
And I'm proud of us. You know, that's the feeling that I had instantly. I'm proud of her for the way that she lived and the way that she died, and I'm proud of myself for the decision that I made to go and throw myself into loving her for the short time that I could. I'm proud of the love that we had,
mm.
and I'm proud of her ex-wife and ex-girlfriend mm. for putting their egos aside and saying, let me help, how can I show up? I'm proud of this cauldron of love.
Could you feel the soul leave the body?
Yes, in fact, I thought I heard it. There were two things that happened in that moment that cannot have happened. And I saw, and I swear I saw her arch, and she didn't because she had no strength. But I swear, in my memory in that moment, I saw her arch, and I heard a breaking sound, like glass breaking.
Mm.
I heard it, but that didn't happen because she had no strength to, you know, she was in her last moments, that wasn't it. And there was one of us wasn't in the room at that moment, but I saw her at the foot of the bed holding Rhea's feet and smiling at her. And later I said, I'm so glad that all of us, because there was a group of us who were mm-hmm. taking care, I'm so glad we were all in the room. And that's when I learned that one of us wasn't. But I said, no, I saw you there. I mean, so strange things were happening in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
She was there. There was a sort of spirit there helping, mm-hmm. and there's, and I saw that even in the suffering of that last moment, as I said, it wasn't a peaceful and gentle death, but in that next instant after she died, Rhea had an expression on her face of absolute satisfaction. I mean, it was beyond happiness. She looked almost smug. She had a look on her face of, oh yeah, whatever she saw in that last instant made her so happy. I don't know what it was, but whatever she saw, whatever she was going into, she was just like, yes. The look on her face was absolute radience. That brought me an enormous amount of comfort too.
You've said that it's an honor to be in grief, and that you understood you had to have a willingness to accept that all that grief brought. What does that mean, a willingness?
Oh, so my whole thing, Oprah, is just, I think willingness is my word. You know, when I said I came here to live a life, what I mean is that I agreed to have the life that was given to me, and I'm willing for it to be this one, whatever it is. And the honor in grief is the rejoicing of having loved somebody so much that their departure breaks you. Not everybody has that. Not everybody has ever loved anybody that much. And so within all the sadness and the sorrow of the loss, there's this heightened, stubborn rejoicing that my heart felt of, we did that, you know? Mm-hmm. We did that, we had love, we knew that, we did that together. Mm. And the willingness is to feel both of those things at the same time. Mm-hmm. The tremendous loss, the irreplaceableness of this person, and the joy at having known love to that caliber.
What did you learn about yourself that you didn't know before through Rhea's death?
Mercy. Mm. There was a quality of mercy that I had to learn. Rhea had always been a teacher of mercy for me, mm-hmm. Through her example. Mm-hmm. I'm a perfectionist, and perfectionists can be merciless mm-hmm. toward themselves and to others. Mm-hmm. Rhea had such a battered life in many ways. She had been a drug addict. She had been a criminal. She had been a felon. She'd been in jail. She'd been in rehab centers, mental hospitals, homeless. She'd been beaten down.
Well, that's why she went out like a thug.
That's why she went out like a thug, exactly. And that's why she doesn't have a grave. She has a placard on the park bench in Tompkins Square Park where she right. used to sleep when she was homeless. That's where she wanted her memorial.
Wow.
Because she survived all that, and she was so proud of it. But having been so defeated by her addictions and her compulsions, having been thrown away by so many people, having been sent to jail, having slept on prison floors, she had a humility where she understood when she saw other people's bad behavior, she had an understanding that there's a person inside of there. Because she remembered, she said, even when I was an addict, she said, I knew I was a good person, I just didn't know how to be. Mm-hmm. And so she was bad. I mean, she was a criminal. Mm-hmm. She wasn't just an addict. She was a true thug. And she said, after I, you know, came out of that, I had to ask so many people for forgiveness, and they forgave me, mm-hmm. that I can never withhold mercy from anybody. It's what I owe, because I was shown mercy. Mm-hmm. And I learned mercy from her, but I also had to find it for myself, because I failed myself so many times in taking care of Rhea. I wanted to be Florence Nightingale. I wanted to be the hero. I wanted to never lose my patience. I wanted to be the best caregiver in the world, because I want to be the best everything in mm-hmm. the world.
Because you're a perfectionist.
Because I'm a perfectionist. Yes. And so I held myself to that standard, and I failed because you can only fail at that. And later,
You failed, but you learned so much more.
I failed that the point is not to come here. You know, Rhea said it at the very end to me. She said, your job was never to be the best caregiver. Your job is to find mercy for yourself. That's your job, Liz. That's your work on earth, is to find mercy for yourself and just be human, and just being human and doing your best. You know, your job was never to be...
That's all of our jobs.
The perfect wife, the perfect caregiver, the perfect friend. The job is to find mercy and compassion.
I read that since her death, that you write to her, you talk to her, that she's helped you in the grieving of her.
Yeah, well, the deal was, I can't live without her, so I don't. I can't live without her, so I don't. When I need her, I call her. Mm. And I discovered that if I,
I understand
a voice
that.
Recorder on your phone. Mm-hmm. So try this, those of you in grief. It's kind of, you got to go with me on this. But I find that if I push that voice recorder button and go to a quiet place and say, hey, Rhea, and start talking to her like I'm leaving her a voicemail message, mm-hmm. something about the fact that it's being recorded makes me feel like it's being received. And I'll have these hour-long phone conversations into my phone talking to her, and I feel like she's receiving it, and I feel like she's telling me what to do when I ask her for advice. Sometimes I can feel like I hear her voice, and other times she'll just put an image in my mind of something from her past to show me, oh, it's like that. Remember that situation?
Mm-hmm.
Remember what we did then? This is how you need to get through mm-hmm. that. And I also write to her. I pick up my laptop and I'll just write, I need to talk to you. And the first time I did it, I felt like such a freak that I was doing it, but I was crying, I was missing her, and I was sobbing, and I said, hey, Rhea, I need to talk to you, and I'm really afraid this isn't gonna work. And she goes, well, you better not try it then. In her voice, typing through my hands, better not try it then if it might not work. And I started laughing, and it sounded so much like her that I said, is this you? And she said, if you believe it is, it is.
And
she says this as
I'm typing through her voice, if you
believe it. That's some woo-woo stuff, I gotta tell you.
And you know what, Oprah? I don't know whether
it is.
I don't need to know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know whether it's her spirit typing through my hands or if it's that she's so braided into me at this point that I know what she would say because I knew her better than I've known anyone.
It doesn't matter.
It comforts me, and I ask for advice, and I get it. And it's because I've internalized her in a certain extent.
Will you write a memoir about this time with her, your time with Rhea?
Unclear. I know it's what everybody expects me to do, and there's a part of me...
Yeah, this is so unexpected, at this moment.
I know that everyone thought...
Because that's our thought, you were going to... Yes.
Yeah, and there's a part of me that's...
But I love that you zig when you think you're going to zag.
Like, I'm not going to do what you think I'm going to do.
I love you zig when you thought you were going to zag.
Nope. And I don't believe that I owe the world that. I don't. I don't believe that... Somebody asked me recently if I felt like I had a responsibility to my readers, and I said... No, I love them, but I don't feel responsible to them, and they're not responsible to me either. No one's responsible to read my books.
Right.
We have a love relationship. You want to be in it, you can be in it. But I don't know. It's I have some ideas about different things.
It will come as it's supposed to come. What you shared when you first sat down here, that's it. You just want all of it. You want to live it. You want to be in the now and be guided by whatever the force of life at any given moment tells you to do.
You say as the wind whips up.
Yes. Hello, force of life.
You just like stirred up the force of life just there.
Hello, force of life.
You guys know that Oprah can summon the wind. She actually has that talent.
Here's the thing. For all the people who fear, who are in it right now, and I know this Super Soul and this podcast is going to come at just the right moment for so many people. Mm. Who are fearing the loss and fearing the grief. Mm. What do you want to say to them about it?
I love you. I love you. That's all I want to say. I love you. You are walking through the darkest thing that you may ever face. And you will survive it. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to know how now. You don't have to know how tomorrow. And you don't have to know how the day after tomorrow. But somehow you will walk through this as everyone has, you know? And you may spend the rest of your life walking with a limp for what you've been through and the loss that you have. But you can do it. It's, I would say to lean into the idea of the honor. I know that it may be too soon for certain people to hear that. They're like, screw your honor. I want my husband back. Mm-hmm. I want my daughter back. I want my sister back. You know, I don't see the honor in that. But you remember Richard from Texas,
from
Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah,
I asked him one time, what do you think about death, Richard? Because he was one of the wisest people I ever met. And he said, well, all I know about it is it seems to take everybody by surprise. And I don't know why, because it's literally the only thing that is in the contract. It's the
for all of us.
Only guaranteed thing. And yet every time it happens, we're shocked. And it's really kind of the one thing that shouldn't be shocking. Everything else should be shocking because everything else is a surprise. But death is the one thing that shouldn't be a surprise. And yet it does feel so shocking when it happens. We're like, what?
Even when you're prepared for it.
Even when you've been preparing for it your entire life, you know? And I don't know what's on the other side, but I know that to help somebody, Rhea and I used to say, she used to say to me, I just want you to walk me to the edge of the river, you know? And she'd say, I don't know what the river is, but I want you with me right to the edge of the river. And to get to, not to have to, but to get to, walk with somebody to the edge of the river is the greatest honor I've ever had in my entire life. Mm. To be chosen by somebody, to be the one who wants you with them at the end of their life is the greatest honor I've ever experienced.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, this is love.
Because by the time you get there and you know you're headed to the edge of the river, you only want the people who are the purest and the truest.
That's it.
Yeah. You only want that to do that walk.
That's right.
But the people who you know are real. There is just no room for bullshit.
And for people's feelings, because there are a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Rhea was very beloved, and there were a lot of people who wanted to be on that walk. And I remember her saying to some friends who were angry that they were being cut out of this last piece of her life, and she said,
I cannot take care of you right now.
Yeah.
I cannot take care of you right now. Yeah. I am dying.
You don't want
Go
people who
need, about
who,
it.
Who have to have their own needs taken care of and you're doing it to,
If you're gonna be in the room with me while I'm dying, you do not make me take care of you.
Whoa.
And she said it flat out to them. And if they started doing that in the room, she would send them out.
Really? Yeah.
She's like, I'm not sitting here watching you cry at me.
I would have to think that if ever you were going to be in the truth of yourself and not worried about what other people are thinking, it's when you're walking to the edge of that river.
She was kind of like that anyway, even on a good day. But like when there were no more, when all the stakes were pulled up, that was it. You know, she didn't have time to baby anybody. She was like, you know, be here helping me or go.
Where do you think Rhea is now? Where do we go? Where does a soul go?
We don't get to know that, you and I, but when I talk to her. Mm-hmm.
Does she tell you where she's at?
Well, she did once. I said, I was really sad. It was Thanksgiving. The holidays are hard, as you know. Mm-hmm. And after you've lost somebody you love, and I.
All the firsts you have to go through.
It was brutal, and I was home at my parents' house, and I kind of left the gathering early, and I went upstairs and called Rhea on my cell phone to talk to her the way that I do, just leaving a voice message to the ether, really, you know, and I was crying, and I said, is it sad where you are? And I heard her voice, felt her voice in me say, well, it depends, baby, is it sad where you are? And what I gathered out of that was, I'm where you are. You know, so if you're sad, Liz, then it's sad where I am, because I'm with you. And if you're happy, then it's happy where I am, because I'm with you. Mm. And I said, can you show me what that looks like? You know, the with you. And the image that I was shown was just me sort of surrounded by carbonation. Just this carbonation, and it was just this sense of just Rhea, just spirit. And so what she's always been reassuring me of is where she is right here. Mm-hmm. Right here.
Hi, Rhea.
I know. Hey, baby.
Hi, Rhea.
And she did always love you, so I'm sure there's no way she was going to miss seeing you.
I just think that's so beautiful.
Feel it. Like, when she said, if you're sad, then yeah, it's sad where I am, because where I am is right here with you at every moment. And I said, are you with everyone who loved you? And she's like, no, I'm just with you. We had such a you know, she's like, no, don't tell anybody, but
oh, my goodness.
I'm just with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's just me. That could just be me comforting me, but it worked. You know, it worked. I felt it.
Are you ready to unlock your inner greatness? If so, make sure to listen to my podcast, The School of Greatness, hosted by me, Lewis Howes. Join me as I sit down with world-class performers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders to uncover their secrets to success with new episodes every single week. Whether you're striving for personal growth, business mastery, or simply seeking inspiration, The School of Greatness has something for you, and you can find it on SiriusXM, Pandora, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe and follow to the show so you never miss an episode and start your journey to greatness today.
So do you feel that for other people that you've lost or that have gone on? No,
never. I mean, I was talking about this recently with somebody else whose best friend died young. Uh-huh. And she said, you know, I can't believe we'd lose these, like, of all the people, like, I've got a list of, there's something so unjust about when people are taken and who is taken, mm-hmm. right? I mean.
Or it feels that way.
It feels that way. You know, like, God, of all people in the world, you had to take that one. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is full of these horrible people. You had to take this one. Mm-hmm. She and I were talking about this feeling that we have where, for the first time in my life, and I think you have this because you've spoken about this with Maya. I have a very powerful ambassador on the other side now.
Yeah.
And I've never felt like that before.
Yeah.
And I've lost people that I loved, but I felt that they couldn't do much for me.
Yes.
But Rhea's strong.
Yes.
And like in the way that Maya's strong. And it's like, I feel like I have
but you know what I think it is
on the other
yes,
side
now. You know what it is? What I have sensed, and I don't know how I know it or feel it to be true. And when friends have lost people that they loved and truly loved them, it's about the love connection.
Yeah.
When somebody has loved you, really loved you, that's how they become an ambassador for you on the other side. It's not everybody who's ever passed.
Right.
But it's why people who've had really strong relationships with their mothers, I now say, you have an angel you can call by name.
Yeah.
And for my mother, we didn't have a strong relationship in her human form, in this form, but it's better now that she's gone.
Well, she doesn't. Can I tell you my, I want to know your understanding of it first. What's your understanding of why that is? Because I have a thought about that.
Well, she never knew me on this side. Huh. She never really knew who I was. And when she got to the other side, that was the first time she actually could see who I was.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you feel that?
I feel that.
You feel that because you hear her tell you that, or you feel it kind
feel
of in
that.
Your body?
It's in my body. It's in, yeah.
It's
just a knowingness. I can't explain how I know it. I know it. Ah, she got it.
Yeah. I've heard this before of people talking about difficult parents, especially, that when somebody very difficult that you loved dies, now on the other side, they don't have an ego anymore. They don't have any more stories, and they don't have any more pathologies. All they have is love.
That's right.
So all of that gets clear. She couldn't see you because she couldn't see you through all that hedge of ego and her own pain and whatever her thing was. And then when that's gone, the only thing left is love. Mm. The only thing left is love.
Yes.
And then you can, love sees everything.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah, I feel that strongly now. So what was your greatest fear that you were able to overcome? And what allowed you to overcome it?
My greatest fear has always been that I'm not a good person. And I'm not trying to get you to say that I am by saying that, but it's
truly, I'm saying so you, yes.
My greatest fear is that I'm not a good person. And what's gotten me to get over that hasn't been becoming the world's best person. It's learning mercy toward myself for the mistakes and failings of my life. Like an attitude toward myself of radical friendliness. Radical acceptance.
And that's why this line about, if not a good girl, I believe that I was a good person.
Yeah.
You're writing about yourself.
I know, I always do. Whether it's a memoir or a novel, the only story I know how to tell is mine.
Yes.
That's always been my biggest fear. That's what's tormented me the most, is a fear that I'm not good.
What was your greatest awakening?
Finding God when I was going through the first pages of Eat, Pray, Love on the bathroom floor.
Yeah.
You know, night after night.
That
bathroom floor moment that every woman I've met who's read Eat, Pray, Love has been like, I know that bathroom floor. Yep. What color was your tile?
Yes.
You know, like Anne Lamott says, people say God is in the details. I think God is in the bathroom. You know, there's something about breaking down in the bathroom. It seems to be where it happens to everybody. Hit that floor. You're at your lowest moment. And I didn't have any kind of God in my life before then. And I got to such a breaking point that there was no way out but through God.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way out but through God. And feeling that night when I was begging God, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? I don't know what to do. And hearing this very loving voice say, go back to bed, Liz.
Yes, I just remember that moment. Go back to bed, Liz. And do you call it God, universal force, love, spiritual consciousness?
I call it God because it's just easy. But I'm happy with source, Gaia, universe, love, she, he, they.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fine with all of that. But for convenience, because most people recognize what you mean.
When you say God.
Say God.
Okay, so when is the last time you were filled with awe?
Mm.
Or what fills you with awe? You can answer either one.
I just taught a creativity workshop at an organization in Philadelphia called Project Home that's run by my hero, a woman named Sister Mary Scullion, the most incredible nun who's devoted her entire life to taking care of the homeless in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most diverse room of people I've ever taught a workshop to, you know, in terms of race, age, intellectual ability. It was just this, and I was like, wow, how's this gonna work, you know? And my God, was that so beautiful. And the workshop that I teach is a series of letters that people write to and from different aspects of themselves. And just watching these people who have been through so much difficulty. These people who are just coming out of homelessness for whatever reasons, whether it was mental illness or addiction or economic injustice or racial injustice or the violence that had happened to them in their youth. And then hearing them write pieces of their story and hearing them stand up and read, I was in awe. It was a bow down moment, you know, and the quality and beauty of the storytelling that was coming out of them was just absolutely magnificent.
I was so struck by what you said earlier about this life that you have now, wanting to live it and whatever shows up. What advice do you have for people who are living a false life and they know it?
It's so hard to get out of it because you're probably entrenched.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say, I mean, I've been using this word a lot just in this conversation, but every good thing starts with mercy. Every good thing starts with mercy. So first thing is mercy for yourself for the situation that you've ended up in. Because I think a lot of the reasons that people get stuck is that they take a wrong turn and then they're so ashamed and then they're trying to cover their shame. And then the shame is debilitating and then they become crippled and stuck and then they don't think they deserve a better life. And then, you know, all of it is just wrapped up in a tremendous amount of shame. And I know shame inside and out. And I also know mercy at this point inside and out. And so begin by laying a foundation for yourself of radical mercy. Okay, you ended up here. Okay, you know, wrong marriage. Yeah. Okay, wrong job. Okay, wrong everything.
So it first begins with acceptance, like, just so this is where I am.
Even before acceptance, mercy.
Before acceptance?
Yeah, because I think mercy, you can even have mercy for yourself for what you can't accept.
Yes.
I just think mercy above all, above all. And then once you've established a certain base note of kindness toward yourself, you can only then start to begin to change, because it's gonna hurt, you know? Mm-hmm. It's gonna cost you, and it's gonna hurt, and it's gonna be painful, and you might not be able to do it, and that's also okay. Mercy in that too. You and I have talked about constantly pushing people toward their passion. You know, like, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
I think one of the most important things I've ever heard you say, you said in a past Super Soul, when you said it freed so many people, this whole purpose and passion, where you said curiosity.
Yeah.
Just being curious.
Yeah. Follow your curiosity.
Is enough.
Which is a scavenger hunt.
Yes.
It's not the voice of God saying, this is your passion, change the world, do this. It's just curiosity is a tiny little impulse that says, what are you a little bit interested in now?
Yes.
It's mild. You can actually do that without blowing your life up.
And let that lead you.
Yeah.
Just follow that.
Always.
Yeah, follow
Always.
That. So describe a moment when you experienced true and pure grace and you knew it.
I was in Indonesia, I was going through my horrible divorce. I was 31. Mm-hmm. I was in a terrible depression. I took myself to this tiny little island and decided I needed to spend 10 days in silence to try to have a truth and reconciliation hearing with myself, because I was so full of shame and pain. Mm. I decided I wouldn't speak, not a word, for 10 days, and I didn't know anybody. I went and got a hut on a beach in this tiny little very poor fishing island off of Lombok in Indonesia. And I got terribly, terribly sick with food poisoning. And my plan was to walk around the island every day, because it was a tiny little island. And there was this one woman, this Muslim woman. I mean, when I say this island was poor, I mean what these people fished that day is what they ate for dinner that night. Mm-hmm. You know. And this one woman on the other side of this island used to see me walking, and she would put her hand on her heart and smile at me when I walked by, and I would do the same to her. And then I got really sick, and I was stuck in my cabin, dehydrated, terrified. I actually thought I had malaria, and far away from anyone who knew me. And this woman came and found me. Something in her knew that I wasn't well. She'd seen me, and she knew I wasn't doing well anyway. But when she didn't see me on my daily walk, she came and knocked on my door and saw the condition that I was in, and went like this, and came back an hour later with fresh food and fresh water for me. And I just started crying in her arms. And she held me in her arms like I was her child, and just rocked me and took care
of me. Did you even know her name?
I didn't know her name, still don't. And by the way, she is my face of Islam. Whenever, you know, whatever conversation in the world is ever happening about Islam, she is my face of Islam. That woman who went across an island, knocked on every door in this little row of cabins till she found the person who she knew was suffering and came and took care of me.
Oh, my God.
That was the most grace I have ever received in my entire life, because she had no relationship with me whatsoever, owed me nothing. This is truly God working through somebody's kindness.
Wow.
What makes your heart whole and full?
My friends. My friends, more than anything. I'm so in love with my friends. You know, I'm at an age now where I've realized that I'm turning 50 this year, and the way that I'm celebrating this year is that each one of my favorite friends I'm taking on a vacation somewhere to do something particular that I knew she would love. So in January, I took my best friend, Jenny, from when I was 9. She's been my friend since I was 9. 40-year friendship. And took her to Mexico, and we just sat on the beach and drank margaritas.
Do you have a lot of friends?
I have a lot of friends. But what I love most is that I have friends that I've had for decades now.
Wow.
You know, so friends for 30 years, 20 years, 40 years. And in each one of them, I'm doing something really special with this year because I can't think of a better way to celebrate being 50. And they make my heart feel so safe and so, so rich and so, so full of love.
Other than the moment you described where you felt like the spirit of your beloved with you, have you had any other transcendental or mystical experiences?
I've had a lot of them around Rhea, I have to say, but I think it's just because she's so powerful.
Yeah.
I've had things happen that seem to be spooky and don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
When Rhea was being cremated, Gigi, her ex-wife, who is my sister now, the two of us decided to go and watch, because we felt like that was part of our contract with her, to take her to the edge of the river, that we would watch
the cremation.
Because Rhea had said she was afraid of being left alone after she died, and so we said, we'll be right with you right till the last flame. And we sat, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever
seen. Those aren't my dogs, by the way, okay? I want everyone to know those are not my dogs.
I have a feeling that's actually the spirit of Rhea.
That must be her thugging around the edge of the fence, okay?
But in that, during that cremation, it takes hours for a body to burn. And we sat there for hours praying, singing hymns.
Does it take hours?
Hours. And it should, because it's so epic. You know,
yes, I know it's
leaving.
Epic, but I would think it just...
takes hours. It
takes
hours.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that.
So we just sat there in this warehouse, in this cold warehouse together, a lot of it in silence and meditation, in prayer, in song, just guiding, feeling like we were guiding her soul into the flames and out into life. And my bag was sitting down here at the next.
Is she like in a furnace or a tomb?
Yeah, in a furnace, which they closed the door of, but we'd asked them to open so we could sort of
watch her burn.
See her, yeah.
You walked to the edge?
Right to the edge.
And all and on into the fire.
Would have gone, I mean, I tell you, Oprah, seeing that, she looked like a Viking king. The nobility, the beauty of watching her turn from earth to flame, from matter to flame, was so beautiful. And I said,
I've never met anyone who's done that.
Gigi and I are weird that way. We just felt we had to. And Gigi said, we looked at her in flame, and Gigi said, I've never seen her look more like herself. Because she was that. She was just this force of flame and power. She was an Aries, you know? So just watching
that,
it was just extraordinary. But in that, 3 hours in, my bag is right next to me. My phone starts playing one of her favorite songs. No one's touched it. I don't have Siri. And this Van Morrison song starts playing out of nowhere.
On your...
While her soul is ascending. And Gigi and I just get up and start dancing. We're like, okay, I don't know.
This is going woo-woo on me.
I don't know. It's never happened before or since.
Woo.
I know.
So
you know me, I'm pretty comfortable.
You're telling me that you're sitting there watching her going up in flame, and your purse is just there, and no one's touched the purse, and the music starts coming out of it. Okay.
I don't know how things work. I just know that it's an interesting ride, and I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Yeah.
I wouldn't miss a minute of it. Not a minute of it. Even, you know, and I said that to Rhea right up 2 days before she died. She said, you've been through hell with me. And I said, I wouldn't miss a minute of this. Not a minute of this. I wouldn't trade a minute of this. Not one minute. I'd do it all over again.
We're going to end right there. Thank you.
Thank you. I love you.
I love you back.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. Woo! That's amazing. Mm.
I'm Oprah Winfrey, and you've been listening to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. You can follow Super Soul on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another Super Soul Conversation. Thank you for listening.